Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation After Dark podcast, fellas. For the second week in a row, it's JC's time of the day, or shall I say night, to shine. He is an absolute night owl. He demanded at least a couple times this season, no, I'm joking, that we tape this podcast at night because it's when he comes out to play. Right, JC?
It is true. I am a night owl. And I think because we're after dark, this is the R-rated version of the Three Down Nation podcast.
Oh, snap.
I still have my assless chaps on from last week's Xbox. Although I've been told that all chaps are apparently assless. I did not know this. I specifically ordered the assless cut, yes.
Where does the terminology come from then, assless chaps?
Know.
Is that
I guess
not redundant?
The absence of pants underneath. Must be.
That's like
what
saying,
defines it as assless.
Oh, this is a hooded hoodie. Like what? Like if all chaps are assless, why do we say that? What an odd thing.
I want to get that image out of my mind.
We did get a ton of compliments though on our picks pod this week. We had a couple really funny moments. So shout out to the people who enjoyed it. We love bringing you those picks, even though not all of them age super well. Stand up Edmonton Elks, 200 yards of Justin Rankin. Incredible.
Indeed. Let's get to the goods, fellas. We're discussing a quarterback controversy, don't you say, in Toronto.
A big addition to Edmonton's offensive line.
Hamilton taking control in the East Division.
And upcoming tribute games, but first, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers saw their Banjo Bowl win streak end on Saturday, but the bigger concerns for the Double Blue come on the injury report for the team. American receiver Dalton Schoen did not suit up for the game after being ruled out for the 2025 season with his second ACL tear, while quarterback Zach Kolaris left a game for a third time this year after taking a high hit from CJ Revis. What level of concern do you have for the long-term future of Schoen and Kolaris?
Let's start with Schoen. I mean, this could be a career ender, right? I mean, Dalton Schoen, two-time All-CFL selection, Rookie of the Year in 2022. Unbelievable couple of years to start that career. But to me, he's almost becoming like a Kamar Jordan right now, where it's like this guy is brilliant when he's on the field, but he just can't get on the field. And that's not Dalton Schoen's fault, right? These are non-contact injuries. Dalton Schoen's a finely tuned, super, super in shape professional athlete. He's not soft. You know, an ACL tear is not your fault. And a lot of people seem shocked when he tried to play through it. Like, what? He was on the field, the torn ACL. I mean, Curtis Rourke, Canadian quarterback, I brought it up, not dunk, said as much. Like, he played all of 2024 with a torn ACL, right? And we don't know if it was a partial tear, a full tear. Unfortunately, that wasn't revealed. I was shocked that Mike O'Shea revealed as much as he did, to be quite honest. But, yeah, I mean, a second ACL tear. Like this is brutal, and I wish Dalton Schoen the best. He's a good dude on top of being a great player. And I really hope I'm wrong. I hope that he comes back, whether it's with Winnipeg or another team, and gets the chance to ball out again. But yeah, like these injuries are brutal. He's 28, like he might be able to bounce back, but we wish him the best. It's awful. As for the Kolaris thing, I mean, this is the third time now he's been knocked from a game. It's not a troubling trend. Everybody knows his history of head injuries. The Bombers, in the nth degree, insist that he has not suffered a head injury at any point this season. It was a neck both times. And I'll say after the Toronto game, I was in the locker room at BMO Field. he, you know, was in the locker room. It wasn't like after a concussion, you know, a lot of guys are sequestered to a dark room, or, you know, they're getting attention from trainers, you know, they're behind closed doors, whatever. Zach was just in the room, and he did seem to be in like some discomfort in taking off his uniform, like bending and stuff. And after this game, like I literally left the stadium 2 hours ago before recording this. Again, he was in the locker room. He was in street clothes by this time, and he was just chatting with players, and he was up and moving. Like, to me, that doesn't scream concussion, but I'm not a doctor, nor will I pretend to be one. We don't yet know as well what the team is classifying this injury as. They might say it's neck. They might say it's something else. We won't know until the first injury report from practice this week. And with the Bombers playing on Saturday, they're probably not going to practice till, honestly, at this point, Tuesday, potentially. So we'll see. As for the injury, I mean, I think Mike O'Shea said it well. He claims he's not concerned about Zach Collaros leaving games this year, though obviously we're talking about 25% of the team's games at this point. And by the way, he also missed two. Like, he's played 10 games and left three times. That's 30% of the games that he hasn't finished. I think you have to be concerned. But Michael Shea says he's not. He's just concerned about Collaros, the person, right? And I do think that's obviously fair. It's easy when guys go out there putting on their helmets, especially if it's the helmet of a team you hate. It's easy to dehumanize these people and pretend that they're not human beings. Zach Collaros has three children. I believe they're all under the age of five. Like, this is a 37-year-old man who I think everybody wants to see live a long, healthy, and happy life after football. And if you don't think that and you wish somebody else ill, well, then you're just a bad person and you need to go reevaluate your life and your priorities. So we wish Zach all the best. Will he be back this season? I mean, it's all over the place, right? We've had these conversations before. Personally, I wouldn't be surprised if he played next week in Hamilton at all, right? But at this point, who knows? There's information here that we don't have. The Bombers will share as little of it as they have to. And Zach will presumably speak on it, but he also doesn't want to talk about his concussion history, which, again, I'm not saying he's had a concussion this year. According to the team, he hasn't. But it's a messy situation. We'll get into the hit a bit because I do want to talk about it, but I'll let JC have a turn first.
Yeah, this is such a difficult situation to analyze because I think everyone's initial reaction, knowing Zach's history each time he's gone down this season, is, oh no, here we go again, right? And it's one of genuine concern from fans of the CFL, certainly fans of the Bombers, but I think anybody who has genuine human emotion for other people and who follows this league, you have that initial reaction. So I sympathize with guys like Milt Stegall, who goes out there on the panel today and says, hey, if this is a concussion, and I suspect it is, then Zach should never play again. Now, that's not what the Bombers are saying, and that's the wrinkle in this. But even if it is a third neck injury, there's clearly something wrong here, right? You should not be on the field if these type of blows, which, yes, it's an illegal hit, but it's going to happen in the course of a football game, are going to take you out routinely. Once, okay, it's an exception. Twice, maybe it's a bad week. Three times now, that's a trend. I'm worried about this injury going forward. And for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, they're not in a situation where they can necessarily be particularly conservative with Zach Collaros' health, because Chris Streveler has been inconsistent when he's been asked to go in there at quarterback. And I think we saw that again on Saturday, where there was a significant drop-off. Even though Collaros wasn't playing extremely well, Streveler certainly didn't light the world on fire in that quarter and a half of action that he saw. So if I'm a Bombers fan, I am extremely concerned about this situation. I'm evaluating where the Bombers are going forward at the quarterback position. I think everyone here would like to see Taylor Elgersma up here in the CFL at some point, potentially be the guy of the future there. But beyond that, they're going to need some other options and start evaluating it. Because at 37 years old, with these type of injuries, if you're getting consistently knocked out of games, you just don't know how much longer Zach is going to last.
We don't really know what the injury is. I think that should be said. And even as Hodge alluded to, the other injuries. And I think, honestly, You said it there, JC. Zach Collaros is a 37-year-old man, and he can make his own decisions. Plus, there is presumably a medical staff in Winnipeg that is watching over his well-being, and Mike O'Shea stating and reiterating to our John Hodge, it's worth saying that Hodge followed up with Mike O'Shea and pushed him a little bit on this latest injury, a clip that was so good that TSN ran it on SportsCenter in terms of Mike O'Shea caring about Zach Collaros, the person. He's not worried about him, the football player. So I would anticipate Zach Collaros playing again because he is that tough, and some people might call it stupid. I don't necessarily think that way, but it's what he has always done throughout his career. He has bounced back from these types of hits no matter how long or short the time frame has been. I'm not saying he's definitely going to play in Hamilton in week 15. Hodge alluded to that as well. I definitely think it's possible. Collaros has shown a lot of toughness, and ultimately this decision lies with him and his wife Nikki and his family in terms of him continuing to play football. You know, it was hard to think that this was a potential concussion because of the way that he was hit and landed on the ground. But concussions come in all different forms and sizes. And if the Bombers are saying it's a neck injury, I mean, all we can really do is speculate otherwise or take them at their word here. I would like to see Zach Collaros have an enjoyable post-football life. But ultimately, when you're playing the game of football, as JC talked about, these types of hits are going to happen. Like, at some point in time, unless you get really lucky, you're going to go through your career where you're hit in a dangerous situation. We've seen all kinds of them throughout our time covering the Canadian Football League, and it's no fun to watch it happen. And it's definitely, you know, less fun to see it happen repeatedly to a player who's one of the known names in this league, who's been one of the greatest quarterbacks of his generation.
As for the hit itself, I mean, CJ Rivas comes unblocked off the edge. I have not seen that clip back, and I'm not going to get access to the All 24 for a few days. For, I think, obvious reasons, nobody posted it on socials because the league does not want to promote itself as a league where quarterbacks get hit in the head.
If not you nobody. Want to see Darren Balming did.
Well, Darren Balming did. Yes. I more mean like from the official channels that post these types of things, Darren Balming, if you want to watch it. Yes. He's got a great slow-mo of the hit. There are a number of things in the CFL that constitute roughing the passer. There are 8 different elements. One of them is delivering a blow to the neck or head of the passer. Another is contacting the passer when either the initial or primary source of contact is the defender's helmet. I personally, watching that, see very clear helmet to helmet from Rivas to Collaros. And I also thought that that was the first point of contact. It wasn't by a lot, but the first thing that I see move on Zach is his head back before the rest of the body shot comes through. And football is an extremely fast game. I'm not denying that. And I don't think that Rivas is a dirty player, but it was a helmet-to-helmet hit that we reported as a, quote, headshot. And frankly, I'm surprised and honestly disgusted that people are trying to classify that as some type of clickbait inaccuracy. If someone hits someone in the head, that is by definition a headshot. And if somebody wants to say, well, in my opinion, a headshot means this, or my opinion, a headshot means that, well, everyone's entitled to their own subjective interpretation of words, I guess, on some level. But as a publication that is independent, we are unable to take the subjective opinion of our hundreds of thousands, if not millions of readers into account when we write our reporting. So if you don't think that was a headshot, that's fine. But when a defender's helmet strikes the helmet of another player, which in this case was verified by the CFL's review panel board, whatever they're calling it these days.
Command
it's not
center.
The command center. It's the replay center. Okay, fine. It's a headshot. Now, I asked the question in my post-game column, why do defenders so often do this? Because this was a disastrous play for everybody. It was obviously a disastrous play for Zach Collaros because he got knocked out of the game. It was also a disastrous play for the Rough Riders because what instead was a momentum shifting explosion play that saw Mike Rose right pick up that fumble deep in Winnipeg territory. All of a sudden, the Bombers get a fresh set of downs and that fumble comes off the board. It was bad for the fans in attendance. They pay their hard-earned money to watch the best players compete, and now Zach Collaros is in the locker room. It's bad for the broadcaster who shells out millions of dollars every single year to put the best of best players on this TV screen for marquee games. Banjo Bowl is a marquee game. And Chris Trevler, credit to him, he was very good in Winnipeg's season opener. But the drop-off from Zach Collaros to Chris Trevler since that game has been massive. And it was massive again. The entertainment quality of this game went in the toilet in the second half. And that sucks because this is supposed to be a marquee matchup of best on best. So to me, defenders, please, instead of aiming an inch below the face mask, knowing that if you're an inch too high, you're going to hit the player in the
Hodge,
face mask.
Man, it's hard, bro.
Just go for
it. Like you're saying it like CJ Revis did this on purpose.
I never said that at all. I said
but that's what you're implying.
No, I'm not implying that at all, that he did it on purpose. What I'm saying is defenders seem to aim an inch below the face mask. And if they're an inch too high, because the league has made it abundantly clear, if you make any contact above the shoulders, like in the head or neck area, it's a penalty. And we see these penalties all the time. Like, why can't you put a shoulder into the guy's abdomen? Now, I asked Willie Jefferson about that after the game. And before people say, well, why don't you ask CJ Revis? Well, you can't go to both locker rooms post game. I said to Willie Jefferson, and he said, well, once you start playing timid, once you start playing slow, that's a slippery slope. And I've got the full quote in my postgame article if you want to read Willie's exact words. So in his opinion, yeah, the game happens fast enough that you can't necessarily put your shoulder in the abdomen. My question is, every football practice that they've ever been to, defensive players hit bags to tackle them, and they drop their shoulder and hit the bag in the middle of the bag to do so. I don't know why players going after quarterbacks do this, because I've said it. I don't think CJ Revis is a dirty player at all. I didn't say that. But he went straight up and his face mask hit Zach's face mask. Why are you putting yourself in that situation to take that penalty? It was a great play. And he took it off the board because it was an illegal hit. And it was illegal. We all agree on that.
If I can address, first of all, why I think that happens to an extent. And I don't disagree with you, Hodge, right? I think that's one of the core issues that we have in the modern game is, how do we alter that strike zone and improve player safety without putting defensive players at a strategic disadvantage? And part of the problem is, in order to go in there and lower that strike zone, you've got to sink down a little bit more. You've got to slow down a little bit more, and players don't want to do that. And in order to sort of build those habits, you've got to exaggerate in a practice setting where you're actually going lower than you would in a game, because whenever you do something in a game, and you'll know this, Dunk, right? If you're not exaggerating what you're doing in practice, when things go full speed in a game situation and you're reacting off instinct, you're never going to do it as much as you did it in practice. So you're going to do about half that much. And if you're not lowering your strike zone extra, then your strike zone is going to be higher than it was when you were practicing, essentially. But you can't lower that strike zone because we are not allowed to hit quarterbacks in the legs either, right? You can't hit them in the knees. You can't hit them low. So you're in this sort of catch-22 where you can't exaggerate the motion and tell them to go low because they're not allowed to go there either. They've got to go in the middle. And then when things are going full speed and they're not able to sink properly, that strike point goes up higher. Now, if it were me, and I'm not a quarterback, and this is a controversial take because I'm on record as saying I don't care about your damn knees, in order to prevent head hits, I would allow lower hits on the quarterback. I really would. I think that's a valuable trade-off in my mind just to protect guys' heads. But I know every single quarterback in the league would definitely disagree with me on that because they don't want those guys coming for their legs. But that is the type of nuance and the things that contribute for an athlete to put them in a position where they're going to be a few millimeters off. And CJ Rivas, that's all he was on this play. It's not a dirty hit. There doesn't appear to be any ill intent here, but it's an illegal hit. It's a headshot. And for anybody who's ripping on Hodge for this headline, because I've seen that a bunch, oh, it's that Homer John Hodge from Winnipeg. I wrote that damn headline. And you guys all know Winnipeg and Saskatchewan both think I hate them. So I'm the most unbiased person here. So it's very clearly in the rule, a shot to the head, a headshot. That's what it is. An unfortunate circumstance, nothing more than that.
There's so many nuances to all of this. Okay, let's start with the word headshot, because my interpretation of the word is a targeted shot to the head, which this was not. But I suppose by definition that you two have laid out, it's making contact with the head, and there's a way that you need to condense it down to have it in the headline. So I'll grant you that. In terms of CJ Rivas, I don't think this was malicious, but by the letter of the law, was the hit illegal? Yes, it was. Now, JC, I don't want anybody trying to take out quarterbacks at the knees ever, okay? But let's go through this, okay? You're CJ Rivas coming full steam on a blitz in a critical game in the third quarter, and you have a guy in Zach Collaros that you know can get outside the pocket and make you look stupid. If you dip your head and take your eyes off the prize, so to speak, and try to put a shoulder into Collaros, and he spins away at the last second because you don't see him, you're going to go viral on highlight reels. The other part of this, too, is if he does lead with his shoulder and comes in at the force he was coming in untouched off the edge, there's a chance that he could get called for another part of roughing the passer, which is driving the quarterback into the turf. Guys,
that's
a valid point. That I'm saying this, but, and I know people count this stuff, but as a former Canadian university quarterback,
I love school.
I think it's ultimately difficult for defenders these days, especially in the CFL and the NFL, to hit quarterbacks. Like at some point, we're playing football here. The first time that I saw that hit, I didn't think that it was bad. I didn't necessarily think it was a flag. I understand the command center has to look at it because Michael Shea challenges it, which was a smart call by him. And yes, by the letter of the law, it is a penalty. But as a former Canadian University quarterback, I'd rather not be hit in the knees. Definitely not. And I don't think I'd rather be pile-drived into the turf by CJ Rivas, Willie Jefferson, or anybody else. I probably would have rather had this hit. The other part of it to me is, and some people might be like, Dunk's out to lunch with this, but I'm sure Collaros would at least acknowledge this part, is that when you look at that play, when you break it down, there were seven men on the line of scrimmage for the Rough Riders. Now, there's no guarantee that all of those guys come, because Corey Mace has shown as defensive coordinator and in his first couple of years with the Rough Riders that he doesn't really send the house very often. But he happened to on this play. So from my memory, you got five offensive linemen. You got the running back in there potentially helping you out in pass protection. If those seven guys come, the quarterback is ultimately responsible for that guy that is unblocked. So I think Collaros got locked into what he was seeing on the left side, and he didn't have that sixth sense that he often does so many other times to make defensive linemen or free blitzers look foolish, and he got thumped. I don't think it was a dirty hit. I think it's tricky for CJ Rivas to come in there full speed and not want to look like a fool, as Willie Jefferson alluded to. That's why I think there's so many nuances to this. And part of it, you know, seems heavy to say, is on Collaros. He's got to get rid of the football in that situation. He's got to recognize that there's a free blitzer there. Now, I'm not saying that it's his fault that he's injured, but I'm sure other quarterbacks, and I bet you Collaros in this instance, would talk about that aspect of it. Now, for some reason, perhaps he didn't anticipate Mace sending seven guys because he hasn't done it very often, but he held on to the football too long. So I actually sort of side with the defenders here, and we've talked about this, I feel like, multiple times on the podcast, fellas, that it's very difficult to strike quarterbacks. Like in that situation, you know, kind of summarizing what we're talking about, we're asking Revis to come off the edge screaming, but like pick him up and put him down like you might your nephew if you were like wrestling them into the couch to not get a penalty. Like it's difficult. You look at the different roughing the passer calls for the 15-yard variety. It goes from A to H in the rule book. Yeah, that's okay. How many nuances there are to the rule.
Yes, but let me interject. You're saying, okay, we're asking CJ Revis to do something that's hard. Can you please list an easy thing to do in professional football?
I'm not saying that it's hard. I'm saying that it's tricky to hit quarterbacks. Nothing's easy in professional football. That's not what I'm getting at. Well, I'm saying actually, I think it's swung too far the other way, where now it's difficult for defenders to hit the quarterbacks in a proper way at full speed.
I would reject on that. I think it would be very easy if I was to go out there in a professional football game for me to get sacked. I could do that very easily.
For the record, I think that Dunk is correct, and I don't want to say this definitively because, again, I need to see the all 24 on it. But there are lots of instances in professional football where the defense blitzes more players than the offensive line or the other protectors can block, like it's 7-on-6, and the quarterback just turtles with the ball and gets crushed. And all the fans turn to each other and are like, man, our offensive line is terrible. And it's like, no, you six people can't block seven. That is on the quarterback to get rid of the ball as quickly as possible. And it's up to the offensive coordinator to have designed a play so that the quarterback has a quick outlet that's going to be open in order to get rid of the ball before getting sacked. And by the way, I was at practice this week. I asked Zach about the 5 sacks that his team gave up in the Labor Day Classic. And he said, this is a quote, I have to get rid of the ball quicker. He literally talked about that. So I'm not saying that Zach doesn't bear any responsibility for taking the sack, but the strike zone in the CFL, just to be very clear, according to the letter of the law, this is a quote, delivering a blow at or below the knees of the passer, close quote, is roughing the passer. So above the knee and below the neck, that is the strike zone. To me, that is still a big strike zone. I appreciate that you don't want to lower the shoulder and whiff, but to me, I don't understand why defenders aren't taught, just put your shoulder in the abdomen. If you aim for the abdomen, you've got a lot of leeway. So if the quarterback ducks, you're still hopefully not catching them in the head. And if they jump, you're hopefully still not catching them in the knees. Because if you aim for the upper chest, that could very easily be a headshot, at which point your sack doesn't count. And defenders hate it when their sacks don't count. It's such a big, amazing play to get that type of thing that gets wasted. I'll add one more thought. I looked it up. I have a retraction here. Merriam-Webster defines headshot as a photograph of a person's head and face. So I was mistaken. It was not a headshot. We need to formally apologize because there was not a single photo that was taken by CJ Revis on that play.
Hodge, though, what you just described is what I'm talking about with the nuances within the rule and also how difficult it is to hit the quarterbacks. And I should reiterate, like it also says in there, you can't land with your weight on the quarterback. You can't drive them into yes. the turf. So the force that Revis was coming with, I think to your point, if he does lower his helmet, it might even be a bigger hit than the one that we saw. To be honest,
fair.
With that and force, him driving through Claris. Now, I'm not saying that that would have been illegal or legal because we would have had to seen the result of the play. But guys, if memory serves, earlier in the year, there was a play where Shane Ray caught McLeod Bethel-Thompson in a compromising position. And some might argue drove him to the turf. And I don't think there was a call on that one, was there?
That to me, and I've said this on the pod, that it's letter B of 8 letters under the official CFL rule book for roughing the passer. It is, quote, contacting the passer in an unnecessary manner, including stuffing them to the ground, violently throwing them to the ground, and landing on them with most of the defender's weight, close quote. That rule is literally never enforced. So I have complained about this before. I see quarterbacks get landed on all the time, and it's never called. So I've said this previously, and I will reiterate it. The rules committee is tasked every offseason with going over things that don't make sense and fixing things and adding to them. The reason the rules are this strict is because in years past, fans and teams have gone, we have too many quarterback injuries. Our league is not as exciting or interesting. When our quarterbacks all get hurt, we have to go to the nth degree to protect them. And those rule changes were made. And if fans and the teams are now saying, you know what, we overcorrected, we want to fix these rules and provide defensive players with more options and opportunities, I think that's fine. But that has to be done in the offseason. You have to call the penalties as they're outlined. Right now, that is an element of roughing the passer that never gets called, which means it's stupid. It's stupid to have a rule that doesn't get called. So that is one that needs to be addressed. And if they want to open other parts of the rule book, that's fine with me. But if there is literally a rule against having the first contact with the head or delivering a blow to the helmet, you need to then call it. And by the way, a lot of people who are very critical about the CFL, oh, this league is Bush League, or, oh, how can you even take it seriously? Well, you had a starting quarterback and two-time MOP get hit in the head and the refs didn't call it, right? There had to be a challenge. Like, it's weird to me that seemingly the narrative is, oh, it's a joke that this was a penalty, and not that, oh, the officials aren't looking after starting quarterbacks in this league, because it was an obvious penalty to me in real time. And if it wasn't a helmet shot and Corey Mace wanted to challenge it and upon review, okay, it's not a penalty, fine. But quarterbacks need to be protected. Officials need to enforce the rule book. And that's what they failed to initially do today. They then fixed it. Regardless, it's a messy situation. Personally, I'm proud of our reporting on this. I think this conversation has been nuanced, and we need to protect CFL quarterbacks. And if we decide that we don't, then we can change the rules to fix that. But as for now, we have to call the rule book as it's written. That's as it's decided upon by the member teams and the league itself. Period. The BC Lions lost their second straight game on Friday as Dustin Crum led a 14-point fourth quarter crumback for the Red Blacks. The Leos are clinging to the final playoff spot in the CFL with Edmonton, Ottawa, and Toronto nipping at their heels. After presiding over another late game collapse, is defensive coordinator Mike Benavides' job in jeopardy down the stretch?
I don't know that it's in jeopardy for sure, but it's certainly becoming a conversation. And I think you can see that the fan base in BC is beginning to turn against Benavides, because this was not their worst defensive performance by far. I think you can argue it was even a dramatic improvement from what they showed against Toronto, where they had bust after bust after bust in the secondary. They were fairly solid for three quarters of that game. They got some decent pressure from that defensive line. Jonah Tavai had a hell of a game, even though they were missing three key pieces up front. But then when the chips were down, they blew a 27-10 lead in that second half, 14 points in that fourth quarter. And that final drive, Jalen Edwards-Cooper gets blown by on a double move by Khalil Pimpleton in a situation where that just can't happen. And it seems like week after week after week, we have this same narrative about the BC Lions, where the offense is good enough to win and the defense just isn't. The tricky part here is mid-season coaching change generally don't work. There's not an easy replacement. Here there is. Ryan Phillips is still in the building. He's the pass game coordinator and defensive backs coach. He was the defensive coordinator in BC from 2022 to 2024. Had some great seasons in that mix before he was essentially demoted when Buck Pierce took over. The only reason he's still on that staff is because they didn't want to expend on the football operations cap to let him go, and he still had a year on his contract. We talked about that in the offseason is sort of an awkward situation. It hasn't seemed to be a problem, but now as we get closer to the playoffs and the Lions are slipping out of contention, does that become an enticing option? I think the counterpoint to it is, well, the defensive back group, that may be the weakest group that the Lions have, and their pass game problems have been part of Phillips' responsibilities. but there has to be a conversation right now about what's happening on that BC defense, whether it's scheme or personnel or just people not vibing with the leadership there. They have not been able to live up to the expectations and are consistently letting these games slip away.
The pressure has to be mounting in BC. Amar Doman showed with his actions by, let's call it, letting go of Rick Campbell that getting into the playoffs and losing in the West semifinal was not good enough last year. Yes, I know it was the year that Vancouver hosted the Grey Cup. But still, if he's not happy with that, and I'm not saying that he should be, obviously wanted to win the Grey Cup at BC Place, then he's definitely going to be upset if the Lions somehow miss the playoffs. And it's in tight now, fellas. You got Edmonton in the mix, beating Calgary at Commonwealth Stadium. I know Jalen Hutchings was out, and Flo Ormilade got nicked up at the end of that football game too. Looks like a lower body injury for him, and Vernon Adams Jr. didn't quite look the same, but the Elks are coming on the strength of Cody Fajardo and Justin Rankin running the football. And then in the East Division, we'll talk about it a little later, but there's a potential for Chad Kelly to come back. You can debate whether or not that actually makes the Argos better because of how well Nick Arbuckle has played. And then Ottawa winning that football game over BC makes this even tighter. Like, if BC wins that game, you could argue, not mathematically, but that the Red Blacks' chances to make the playoffs are all but over. And BC has some cushion there. But that's how big that loss was. And I think that's why it's a reasonable question to ask about Benavides and his job security. The tricky part is, though, if you're not going to go to Ryan Phillips with the football operations cap, you can't really make a change there unless you're going to say to a guy, hey, come in for potentially a little bit of money that we might have left under our football operations cap this year, and we'll get up with you, or we'll make it up for you on the flip side.
Let's look at the schedule for the BC Lions the rest of the way. They host Ottawa for the second half of this home and home on Friday night. We don't yet know if Drew Brown will play, but obviously Dustin Crum was the only 300-yard passer in the CFL in Week 14, so maybe it makes sense to roll with him. Dustin Crum, I will also point out, as much as I'm not a huge fan of his game, he's won two starts this year. That's the same number as Drew Brown, so maybe it's time to put a little respect on Dustin, the Crumback Crum, the Crumback Kid, if you will, wiping the crumbs off his chin, getting it done late in games. I just think if I'm the Ottawa Redblacks, I need to pay off the scoreboard operator to have it always say fourth quarter, because the first three quarters of the game, Dustin Crum is a completely different human being than fourth quarter Dustin Crum. First three quarter Dustin Crum is go back to Ohio. Fourth quarter Dustin Crum is Hall of Fame. So that's what I would do if I was the Ottawa Redblacks. Slip. I don't know how much it costs to bribe somebody in Vancouver, JC. Here in Winnipeg, it would be a 20. You can get what you want for $20. Vancouver, it's probably 100. Slip somebody, get a big four on that scoreboard. But as for the rest of the schedule, after the Ottawa game, BC then has to go to Calgary. Stampeders obviously got wiped this week. They're still a very good team. They then host Toronto. They host Calgary, Stampeders twice. Then they host Edmonton. They've already got the season series against Edmonton, but obviously they just played very well against the Stampeders. And then the Lions have to go to Saskatchewan. Now, I'm sure for the Lions' sake, they're hoping, okay, please, please, please have the Riders wrap up first place by that point, and we'll play the backups in Regina. But my point is, this is not an easy schedule. Yes, you're at home for four of these six games, but Calgary twice, a potentially surging Edmonton Elks team, a Toronto team that might be getting their MOP quarterback back. Like, this is not an easy schedule for the BC Lions. I'm not going to speculate on Mike Benavides' job security, but what I will say is one of my concerns is that the best defensive lineman for this team pretty consistently when I watch their games is Jonah Tavai, the coffee can, 5'10", 285 pounds. He beat, I forget which tackle it was this week, but I think it was more just unbelievable bull rush, gets the sack, gets the pressure. And I never see Matthew Betts seemingly flash anymore. The Lions are paying Matthew Betts over three times what Jonah Tavai makes. Matthew Betts needs to be a better, more impactful pass rusher. He's never been a world beater against the run. He's a CFL defensive end. That's fine. But when Jonah Tavai is getting to the quarterback more consistently than Matthew Betts, that's a problem for me.
And I think that's the argument in favor of Benavides, is saying, look, we've been talking about the Lions personnel on defense for 2 years now, and they haven't made enough improvements. This offseason, Ryan McMahon comes in as GM. He talks about how they want to get tougher. They want to get grittier. They bring in guys like Micah Awe, Deontay Williams. And as much as I like the physicality that those guys bring to the defense and the fact that Micah Awe can rack up tackles, in terms of actual playmaking ability in space, they're fairly limited. And it's contributed to a lot of these busts and these problems, right? There's not enough talent. There's not enough speed and agility and just a je ne sais quoi to that defense right now. And that goes back to the front office, not necessarily to the defensive coordinator who's desperately trying to put these pieces into place. The other thing is they haven't been disciplined enough. And that goes to the head coach. And anybody who's saying, well, Buck Pierce shouldn't stick around next year, that's a ridiculous statement. He's got a long leash to grow and learn in this job. He's done everything that's been asked of him on offense. But the Lions were second last in penalties coming into this game. And then they went 9 for 105, five of which were in the fourth quarter, four of which were major penalties in the fourth quarter when the game was on the line. That has happened consistently for them, game in and game out. It's been the same guys over and over again. We all know who it's going to be, and there hasn't been the changes, and it hasn't been addressed yet in the locker room, where clearly that message hasn't sunk in. I think one of the concerns with Pierce is he's more of a soft-spoken guy. Is he going to have that power to make that rah-rah speech and hold guys accountable? That's part of what being a head coach is. He needs to step up in that room right now and ensure that they're more disciplined going forward, because right now the penalties have racked up. They've been fined a number of times. They've had ejections. They've had suspensions, and it's just keeping getting worse. It can't keep going like that if you're going to make the playoffs against these teams, whether they got backups in or not, because they've lost to Dustin Crum, Nick Arbuckle, Chris Streveler, and Jake Mayer. Four backups. They've all beat them soundly. That doesn't look good on the resume.
Let's go back to Dustin Crum for a second and give him his due. And I say this respectfully. If his talent matched his toughness, he would be an elite CFL quarterback. And I think I could solve the Ottawa Redblacks interim quarterback issue, let's call it. You just take Dustin Crum and you mash him together with Drew Brown and you got your guy. Because there are some people around the Canadian Football League that wonder, okay, you know, how come Dustin Crum isn't playing, how come Drew Brown isn't playing more consistently? There are whispers out there. Is he really hurt? Why can't he play through some of the nicks and bruises that perhaps other quarterbacks play through in the Canadian Football League? Some people might not want to hear it, and I'm only saying it because I've heard it from multiple people throughout the Canadian Football League, but you cannot question Dustin Crum's toughness. This guy takes hits, keeps going. He might not be the most talented guy, and again, I say that with all due respect, but he does certainly show up in the fourth quarter. And that throw to Khalil Pimpleton was not easy because he had to fit it in a window there before the high defender came over. And I know Edwards Cooper got beaten on the double move, but still, Crum had to fit it in there. So we see flashes of his arm talent. And some people have speculated to me, hey, if Dustin Brown had... What did I just say? Dustin Brown, yeah, that's the quarterback. That's the quarterback that should be the quarterback for the Ottawa Redblacks, is what I'm getting at.
I think that the official name should be Drewston Crown.
Drewston. You got me all confused, bro. It's when we do these at night shows. I can't speak properly.
The Toronto Argonauts were on a bye this week, but the Double Blue did not stay out of the headlines as injured quarterback Chad Kelly released a video on social media teasing his return to the lineup in Week 15 against Edmonton. Kelly hasn't played since breaking his leg in last year's East Final, while Nick Arbuckle has the Boatmen on a winning streak and is currently leading the CFL in passing. Which quarterback should start going forward?
You know, the fact that this is even discussion is a major credit to Nick Arbuckle and what he's been able to do, especially after a slow start. But the simple answer is Chad Kelly. Ryan Dinwiddie has gone on the record multiple times, and I forget the exact phrasing, but essentially saying that Chad Kelly's best quarterback in the Canadian Football League. I'm not going to go that far, but I don't think that there is any doubt that the Argos could be better with him. And I say could because we don't know how he's going to respond to live game actions, the first game out, and subsequent games after breaking his leg in a gruesome injury in last year's East Final. That is something I think that gets lost on a lot of fans and even media members as well, is we just think players magically recover, come back, and they can be themselves. Usually, you know, we talk about it with an ACL injury, that there is sort of this lag time for a player, you know, getting back to where they were. Like years ago, that used to be a career-ending injury, like decades ago. But now I still think there's a lag time. And with a broken leg, I can only imagine the emotions, the feelings that will be going through Chad Kelly if indeed he does get back on the field in week 15 or this season after that awful injury that he went through. Like, I've seen a couple of these up close and personal. I think it was 2009 with the Guelph Griffins. Yes, that's a drink because I said Guelph. Cam Thorne, who was a defensive lineman at the time, actually played offensive line in the CFL for a number of seasons, had a terrible leg injury. Essentially, you heard this snap and everybody parted like the Red Sea because they heard it around the stadium at McMaster. Now, fortunately, he was okay, got carted off in the ambulance, went and had some screws put in there, and now shows off the scar. But it's scary. It's not easy to come back from. So I think it's a sober reminder that these guys aren't just robots. You know, we see them leave on a cart, and then they come back looking like superhuman from these injuries. But there is so much work, let alone what goes into a recovery from a mental standpoint, which I don't think we talk about enough in pro sports, for these guys to get back on the field. So I do think the Argos would be better off with Chad Kelly, though that is a valid debate at this point. But let's see how Kelly actually plays, because it's going to be difficult for him to cross that mental hurdle.
To me, my answer is Nick Arbuckle. I think you play Nick Arbuckle until he stubs his toe, and then you can go to Chad Kelly. If you're that concerned about Chad Kelly and his ability to protect himself, one good way to protect him is don't give him 60 minutes. Like, this is a guy who hasn't played football in 10 months. And last season, he barely played half a year. He was suspended for the first 9 games, and then he got sat for the season finale. Like, Chad Kelly, since the 2023 season, right, when he had that disastrous East Final and the 16-2 Argonauts lost, he won MOP. But since taking that MOP trophy, he has played 8 games in 22 months. Like, he has just not played that much football. So I don't see why you have to go from 0 to 100. Nick Arbuckle's playing good football right now. The Toronto Argonauts are not 4-8 because Nick Arbuckle is not a good quarterback. They are 4-8 because they give up more big plays on special teams than anybody else. They give up more points per game than anybody else. They give up the most yardage per play of anybody else. Like, this team has not played well enough defensively and on special teams, right? This team lost a ton of talent outside of the quarterback spot from 2023 to 2024. Everybody wrote them off. They won the Grey Cup. They lost a ton of talent offensively, defensively, special teams from 2024 to 2025. Everyone said, oh, we can't write them off this time. They won the Grey Cup the last time we did that. And guess what? It actually caught up to them. So I think you start Nick Arbuckle. And if he gives you a reason to, great. Put in Chad Kelly, not a problem. I think that's the best recipe for success. Is that what Ryan Dinwiddie will do? No, I think he's going to start Chad Kelly. But that is what I think he should do going into this week.
I agree with you, Hodge. I don't think there's any debate here on who the quarterback for the Toronto Argonauts is long term in 2026 and beyond. It's Chad Kelly, right? He's the guy. He will get that job. But when you're talking about right now and you're a team with momentum, the question that I come back to with Nick Arbuckle playing so well, doing the things that he's done this year, showing the toughness that he's shown, is whose team is this really right now, this version of this team? Because with that much turnover, there's a bunch of guys there who have never played with Chad Kelly on the field, right? He's practiced a little bit with them, but he's spent a bunch of time in Buffalo as well, rehabbing. He doesn't have those relationships, and maybe it's a little bit of PTSD from last year in BC talking, but you don't want to mess with the formula when there is a team rallied behind one guy. And if this team believes that they are Nick Arbuckle's, then you let him ride it out until he struggles, and then you have a justification and a reason to put in Chad Kelly that everybody can understand. Otherwise, you run the risk of putting in Kelly, him struggling because of all the things that Dunk laid out and the time he's been away and not having those reps, and everyone in that room going, well, why isn't Nick playing? He didn't deserve to be pulled. He was doing great. We were running with Nick. And then all of a sudden, all the momentum that you've built has fallen apart. It's a delicate, delicate ecosystem in a football locker room. And I think you've got to run with the hot hand.
It does kind of remind me a little bit of BC last year. And again, people are going to hate this, but I'll go back to when I played 2009. I was suspended for a game. I'm not going to say it so people don't have to take another drink. But
wait. What position did you play?
QB.
Oh, okay.
You asked a question, so I'll give you an answer. But 2009, I was suspended for a game for dropping a four-letter word national television. Anyways.
Rhymes with muck, right?
Yes. Walk as well. But to your point, JC, you know, but the timing and the rhythm, I was taken out of practice and everything for that week because the starter needs to get their reps, and then came back and just, you know, couldn't find it. I don't think I was as mentally sound as I am now to handle that type of situation. It would have been, you know, much better if I could go back in time. That's obviously not going to happen. But when you sort of build that rapport, build that timing, build being in sync with your receivers and your offensive linemen and all that kind of stuff, I think those are valid points that specifically you're making, JC, is that if Chad Kelly comes back in there, you know, it's a bit odd, I think, potentially for the locker room to say, hey, like, you haven't even been with us all season. All due respect, you've been rehabbing and in and out and been in Buffalo and, you know, potentially who knows wherever else. It seems like Chad Kelly's been around there a decent amount, but he just hasn't had the amount of reps this year for the timing. So to just stick a guy back in there, I don't think Ryan Dinwiddie is going to expect him to play to an MLP level if indeed Kelly becomes the starter once again, but it's going to take time. Like, it definitely is going to take time, but the media and the fans are not going to give Chad Kelly that time to get back in rhythm. Because even from my experience, being pulled out for 1 week and then going back into it, and it wasn't even an injury, disrupted the timing. Now, I would imagine Chad Kelly is much stronger mentally than I was when I was in my early 20s at this point in his career. So I think he could probably handle it better. But that's another element to this if you put Kelly back in. The Hamilton Tiger Cats have taken a 4-point lead in the East Division after a 26-9 win over the Montreal Alouettes on Saturday. With the season series clinched over Montreal, is there any chance the Tiger Cats do not finish first in the East?
I mean, this is the CFL. Anything can happen. But right now, I would put the odds of the Hamilton Tiger Cats finishing first in the East Division somewhere around 99%. Like, they have now won the season series emphatically over the Alouettes. Granted, neither of those games they played were against Davis Alexander, but all you can do is beat the team that's in front of you, and there are no more meetings between these two teams. Now, the Tiger Cats' remaining schedule, they host back-to-back games, and they also finish the season hosting back-to-back games. You like having four games at home. They've got Winnipeg this week, then Edmonton. Then they go on the road to Winnipeg and Toronto. They finish at home to Calgary and Ottawa. At this point, Ottawa is looking like not a playoff team, but you never know. The Edmonton Elks, potentially also not a playoff team, though they are surging. Winnipeg in week 15 might be a slam dunk if Zach Kolaris doesn't play. We'll have to wait and see. But the point is, like, this team is in a fantastic place to finish first. They've got a four-point lead over everybody else. They've got the season series against Montreal. The season series against the Toronto Argonauts is still up for grabs. The rubber match will be that week 18 matchup that I threw out. And the Ottawa season series, they won the first meeting and the second meeting. So there is a third meeting, but they've got that season series too. Like, if you're a Steeltown fan, I don't think you want to ever count your chickens before they've hatched in the CFL. But given the way Bo Levi Mitchell is slinging the rock, given the way that this team is, I mean, I don't want to call the East a turtle derby because I don't think that would be fair. But, I mean, we've talked about this on the show. I'm of the opinion that the top two teams in the league should get the first round bye. And
don't
if that was the case,
start this up again.
I'm just saying, if that was the
we're
case,
we're still getting proposals.
There would be a lot of intrigue in yes. Hamilton. It's like, can they catch Calgary? Can they catch Saskatchewan? As the rules stand, there's not really much to get excited about this last third of the season for Hamilton. Like, yeah, you got to punch your ticket, but at the end of the day, like, the ticket is 99% punched, and I think they'll do it. I think they're the best. Like they're maybe Davis Alexander comes back and the Alouettes go on a crazy run. By the way, I mean, I'll address the Alouettes really quickly here. When you get Tyson Philpott, Austin Mack, Mustafa Johnson, Marc-Antoine Dacroix, David Dallaire, all those guys back, I was like, okay, let's go and see what this team can do. And to completely fall on their faces in this one was awful. Like, this team has lost five straight. It almost feels like they should feel lucky to be 5-7 at this point and still be in a position to make the playoffs. But for that reason, yes, I think the Hamilton Tiger Cats will finish first. I'm not saying it's guaranteed to happen, but I think there's an extraordinarily high chance it's going to happen. And I wish that the CFL's playoff rankings were more interesting because there'd actually be something for them to shoot for. As of right now, it feels like there's not.
I don't know that I agree with you on every point there, but we can agree on the fact that the Hamilton Tiger Cats are the most likely team to win the East Division. I wouldn't put it as high as 99%. I think they've shown that they have the capacity to lose some winnable games, right? That upset against Toronto on Labor Day. They slipped up against BC after beating them the first time. Like, there's some games that they've missed, and there are people that you'll talk to around the league who will ask the question when Hamilton was on that six-game win streak, if you really go through it, who did they really beat, right? Now, I think that's overblown at times in the CFL because everyone plays the same eight other teams, and not all of them are, shall we say, juggernauts, right? There's only a couple of teams in any given season that have that type of reputation. So every resume has holes poked into it. But the Hamilton Tiger Cats have shown they're vulnerable. Anything can happen here. Toronto's hot. Ottawa's coming off a win. Montreal might look like a different team when they get their starting quarterback back. Although I'm fairly confident and would put down money that the Ticats will win the East in the regular season. It's going to be who's the better team over this next six-game stretch that determines who's going to win in the playoffs. It's often not the team that's been the best team the whole way. It's the hot hand, and I'm not sure that that's going to be the Tabbies.
If I'm Jason Moss and Dana Machocha, I'm like, Davis Alexander, your hammy's had enough time. Get back in there because, man, he is into it on the sideline. They've played this out about as long as they could to almost the nth degree to risk potentially not being first in the East Division. It's like, it's go time, bro. I know he probably does want to go. I'm not saying that's on Davis Alexander, but it is time for him to make his return if Montreal wants to have a legitimate shot at first in the East. Hodge, the Tiger Cats 99%? Bro, are you crazy?
No. And I'll point out the schedule. Ottawa and Montreal play each other twice. Toronto and Ottawa play each other once. And Toronto and Montreal play each other once. So, like, Ottawa and Toronto do not play. My mistake. Ottawa and Montreal play each other twice. That is correct. And Toronto and Montreal play each other once. That is correct. So, right there, you've got potentially a situation where you're in first as Hamilton and the teams below you are cannibalizing each other. Like, I think it's really hard to envision a path. Like, if the Ticats just win four of their last six games, they're guaranteed first. Nobody can catch them. If they win four, they go 500, then someone else has to run the table to catch them. Do you think that's going to happen? Think that's likely? I think there's more than a 1% chance. More than 1%. Yes. Okay, what percentage do you give that?
If Davis Alexander plays the rest of Montreal's games, let me hear the schedule. Pull up Montreal's schedule.
Okay, Montreal is at Saskatchewan, at Toronto, versus Calgary, versus Ottawa, at Winnipeg. Montreal has yet to go to Saskatchewan or Winnipeg, arguably the two hardest places in the CFL to play.
I mean, that Winnipeg game's at the end of the season.
It is
Montreal
the last
have to
game
run
of
the whole table. If Hamilton went 3-3, that would leave them 10-8.
Correct.
Montreal would need to win.
They'd have to get to 11 wins. Right now they're at 5. They'd have to go 6-0. They'd have to go 6-0 to get to 11 wins.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, the math ain't mathin'. I've done the math here. It's possible for someone to catch Hamilton, but like they need the Ticats to go like 2-4 down the stretch. And that could happen. Again, it's the CFL, but like I think Hamilton probably splits with Winnipeg. They probably, like they get Edmonton at home. I think that's probably a win. Maybe they stub their toe in Toronto. That's a rivalry game. But then they've got Calgary and Ottawa to end the season. Like you lose to Calgary, beat Ottawa. That's 3-3. That gets you to your 10 wins. Is Montreal really going to run the table? Is Toronto going to run the table? Toronto could pass you if they beat you head to head and they win every other game. I don't think the Argos are going 6-0 to end the season. I don't.
I guess I'm saying I don't think it's 99% because the Ticats have let some winnable games slip away.
Fair.
And I don't necessarily think it's a guarantee, but I'm having a hard time putting a number on it now when you lay it out like that. Like really, Toronto's probably not even in the conversation, neither is Ottawa, to be in first. It's like Montreal is the main challenger and they're legitimately going to have to run the table or go 5-1 even to have a chance. Now that depends on what the Ticats do. But that's, I think, where I'm coming at it from is like, I think there's some chinks in this Ticats armor, if you will, and they have the potential to have accrued even a bigger lead in the East slip away a couple of times.
Actually, talking about this, we'll go off in a sec, but now that we're talking about this, so Montreal is 4 points down, Toronto 6 points down. The difference is the Alouettes have already lost a season series. The Argonauts have a head-to-head game against Hamilton left, and the season series is up for grabs. So one could argue that despite being at 4 wins instead of 5, the Argos are actually closer than the Alouettes are to passing, right? The Ticats, because they can still win the season series, and they've got a game against them.
But in your theory there, even if they go 3-3, I guess if the Argos did win, the Argos would have to win all 6 of their games.
Correct.
For what it's worth, there is math that has been done. It's not up to date after this weekend's results. The CFL's playoff probability calculations, for whatever stock you'll put in that, the odds to win the East before this week, Hamilton was at 75.84%. Presumably, that's risen with their victory. The next highest, even before this week, was Ottawa at 10.85%, followed by Montreal at 8.23%, and then Toronto at 5.08%. Now, those numbers are outdated now. Presumably, the teams that have won have gone up. The teams that have lost have gone down. And we'll see how this plays out when they do their next simulation. but that is the number. So I'd put Hamilton winning at 80-85%, not 99%.
I think that's too low, but agree to disagree. Let's hear your random neg lister, JC.
Well, I attacked this week's neg list project with the idea of trying to find who could be an heir apparent to Zach Collaros, if indeed he does decide to step away from the game after this season. I think we all know Chris Streller's not the guy. Terry Wilson doesn't appear to be the guy. Chase Artopias is in the building. We'll see what he is. Taylor Algarisma could be coming in. We all hope that he can be a starter, but who else could be in that competition? And the guy on the neg list that stood out is Bryce Perkins out of the University of Virginia. He was just in training camp with the Carolina Panthers. They only played him in one of their preseason games, but he went 10 for 11 for 71 yards in that action. Very efficient in limited time on the field. Before that, he was in the UFL. He was the UFL MVP with the Michigan Panthers, threw 14 touchdowns, 3 interceptions in 8 starts, and ran for 6 more. Before that, he was with the Los Angeles Rams, won a Super Bowl with them, learned in that Sean McVay system. He's a legit dual threat guy, 28 years old now. He can still move. He's great in an RPO offense that I think is well suited to the CFL game. And he's improved his protection of the football since his time with the Cavaliers. You can see his touchdown interception ratio in the UFL last season and how impressive it was. I think he's a guy who's available right now. You could bring him in at the end of the season like PJ Walker without the interception problems. He's that type of guy who could potentially be in the mix as an older insurance policy going forward.
I will say, JC, I think I might have heard you say error apparent. Did you say error apparent?
I said no. PJ Walker is an error apparent. That's
oof. Error apparent. And I think Taylor Algarisma, a name that you mentioned earlier, could be interesting in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. but I also don't want to sit here and pretend like Zach Collaros' career is over. I think that's unfair, but all we're doing at this point is speculating. There are facts we don't yet have. As for Hodges' heritage moment, this is for September 7th, when this podcast will be posted. On this day in 1996, the Toronto Argonauts defeated the Winnipeg Blue Bombers by a score of 66-25, setting a new CFL record for most points scored in a single game by a visiting team. Doug Flutie and the Argos would, of course, go on to win the Grey Cup 10 weeks later after finishing the regular season at 15-3. I'll ask Justin first. If you paid your hard-earned money to go to a football game and the other team scored 66 points, how pissed off would you be leaving that stadium?
I wouldn't be pissed at all, man. You got to see Doug Flutie, arguably one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time.
I more meant just like a hypothetical, the other team. I would also be jacked to go see Doug Flutie, but fair enough. JC, would you be pissed off if you went to a game and the opponent racked up 66?
Oh, man. I've been to a lot of high school games where I've had to pay for the buses to get there and then lost by 66. So, yes, I'd be very disappointed.
Fair enough.
Let me shine a little spotlight on a Canadian quarterback. Ooh. Here, okay, fellas? Because I need my own segment.
QB, the new segment alert.
We'll see if it's going to be a weekly thing or not. People are sick of me talking about Canadian quarterbacks, but let's give them a little love, okay? Because Anton Amenrud, University of Saskatchewan Huskies starter, set a personal single-game career high with 418 passing yards and tied a single-game career high with 4 passing tutties, going 25 of 37 in a dominant, and I mean dominant, win over UBC. Sorry, JC. 51-14 at Griffith Stadium. And fellas, there were over 9,000 fans in attendance. So the people in Saskatchewan supporting their football and got our message. You got to go out here and watch the potential stars of the next generation in the Canadian Football League or perhaps the NFL. I'm not saying Amenrud's going to make the CFL, but he was throwing to a Riders draft pick, Daniel Weeb, who in that game had 9 catches for 190 yards and 2 touchdowns. So we'll see if this becomes a weekly thing, but I think Amenrud deserves a shout out. There was a lot of chatter about him you know, last couple of years needing to dial back his interceptions. And I think working with Mason Nias, who's a full-time coach on that staff now, an assistant head coach with Scott Flory, still as the main bench boss, I think Nias has helped out Ammonrude. And that's quite a performance, fellas, as the Huskies improve to 2-0. The Regina Rams are 2-0. Looks like it could be, it's early in the season, but a possible rematch in the Hardy Cup between the teams on the prairies.
Let's go to the three-minute drill.
Oh, yeah. The Toronto Argonauts will honor former owner and legendary Canadian actor John Candy with a celebration game in Week 15. Did anyone love the CFL more than Mr. Candy?
I think it's possible to love the CFL as much as John Candy. I mean, the late Craig Smith would probably be up there. I'm not sure if it's possible to love the CFL more than John Candy or Craig Smith. The Edmonton Elks have signed Canadian offensive lineman Carter O'Donnell after 5 years in the NFL. According to my sources, it's through 2017 or 2027. Pardon me. How big of an addition is he?
He's a massive addition. This is a very talented player. He started games in the NFL. I think he can contribute on that Elks offensive line. And as we know from the CFL Combine in Edmonton a few years ago, he is my doppelganger. So it's always good to bring somebody that's sexy into the building. Oh. Good for morale.
I wonder if he brought assless chaps.
Canadian offensive lineman Sidy Sow signed a practice squad contract with the Houston Texans this week. Could he help if needed?
I think he could, man. He started 14 games with the New England Patriots. And I'm still kind of surprised they let him go, but it's a new regime there. So I think this could be a value add for the Texans. The University of Manitoba is the latest U Sports program to undergo a rebrand. Where did they end up in our rankings there? Is that part of the reason why they decided to do this?
The old Bison's logo ranked pretty high. I do think this new one is better. The inclusion of blue is the thing that will take some getting used to. The University of Manitoba, for what its record, their logo is actually on the field at Princess Auto Stadium. Started to incorporate blue in 2019. I mentioned that because some people have said, like, oh, they're doing this to be like the Bombers. That's not the reason. I think it's a good logo. But again, like, the color change is going to be what takes time for me to get used to it. And for the record, my sources indicate the football team will not be adapting these colors or this logo until 2026. So it'll be some time before that happens. The Saskatchewan Huskies crushed the UBC Thunderbirds 51-14 this week. Dunk already talked about it. Anton Ammonrude. JC, how do you explain your alma mater getting absolutely eviscerated?
Well, Drew Viotto, their big-time transfer quarterback, hasn't lived up to expectations yet. But the biggest thing is, not just Ammonrude playing well, the Huskies, 635 yards of net offense. You cannot win a football game when you're giving up that much yardage. That defense is missing some pieces. They're in a transitional phase. They're going to need to step up if UBC is going to improve. Over 30 Canadians are with NFL teams to start the 2025 season. Which one are you most excited to watch, Dunk?
Chase Brown is an obvious pick, so I'm going to go with Elik Iomanner. I think he's a very intriguing NFL prospect who was selected at a value in the fourth round by the Tennessee Titans. It looks like he's going to start the 2025 season as Tennessee's third receiver behind Calvin Ridley, who is their top target. So I'm curious to see what he can do. You know, he's been brought in there in year one with Cam Ward, who was the number one overall pick. And if they can develop a rapport, it could be a dynamite tandem for the Titans. The Hamilton Tiger Cats will honor general manager Ted Gavea during Week 15's clash with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers as he continues his battle with cancer. That's a worthy tribute, right, Hodge?
It is, and if you follow the Team Ted link, it's on the Ticats website. We've linked to it a number of times. You can buy a Team Ted t-shirt, which goes into supporting initiatives that will be launched in Ted, like to honor Ted. There's some scholarships and things. You can also, using the website, fill out a message of encouragement if you want to send something to Ted, of course, as he continues on with this battle. So I'm absolutely looking forward to this game. I think it's great that Ted is getting this recognition, and I wanted to let fans know about that link in case they'd like to send along some well wishes or buy a t-shirt in support of him. St. Mary's University smashed the Bishop's Gators by a score of 33-7 on Saturday. For context, the Gators went 8-0 last year in the AUS. JC, are the Huskies the new top dogs out east?
Well, this victory puts them in the front of that race because the Gators were a dominant team. Not just 8-0, but 8-0 in dominant fashion last season. The only caveat here, Sengafax also 2-0 right now, and they haven't allowed a single point yet. That will be a big-time clash when the Huskies meet the X-Men. Vernon Adams Jr. and Willie Jefferson were named the top CFL players for the month of August by Pro Football Focus. Did either of those selections surprise you?
Yeah, to be honest, I would say both. You know, it's surprising that Trevor Harris wasn't the player of the month from a quarterback standpoint, and that Jalen Hutchings, who we've talked about a bunch, wasn't at the top there in the defensive rankings. I think this is where data can differ sometimes with the eye in the sky, because it doesn't lie. And the way that PFF does some of their rankings, you know, doesn't necessarily account for all the time what people are actually assigned to do on a play. And then even just some of their calculations are befuddling to me sometimes. So yes, both did surprise me.
For Justin Dunk and JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. This has been the Three Down Nation podcast. We thank you as always for listening, watching. Don't forget to subscribe, like, give us money.
Five stars.
All the wonderful things. Tell your friends and enjoy our picks when I come back with JC later this week for week 15. Hopefully him and I will do better in week 15 than we did in week 14. Until then, we'll see you later.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.